I've been out at their house, and I think he's in China at the moment.
You're sitting there. Okay.
He isn't on the air yet.
We're set.
Oh, he's on the air.
The early members of the faculty, there weren't many of them, they had to cover a lot of subjects, were generally speaking the products of small liberal arts colleges, particularly Williams College, where there were good academic standards, but where I think the emphasis was on classics and mathematics. So Greek and Latin figured very heavily in
the archives.
And who is usually positive.
Yes. And oh,
very good. Very good. I mean, he, Jim, at least as I always remember him, was very crisp and clear on his recollections.
And Blazer is interesting because he was from Manitowoc. And,
right.
He wasn't what you would think of as a typical experimental college student, but he said it absolutely changed his life in lots of ways. Positive ways.
He doesn't know what he would have been if he'd gone to a regular college. So
that was an interesting.
It was like they're a little like the Reed College kids. By having been in it, they assumed they were geniuses, and many of them carried on that way. They still, I think, got more productive because of it.
Sort of an example of the self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Oh, the one other rule for this interview that I should lay down right away is I'm going to be an invisible narrator. In other words, you're not going to hear me on the final production.
Uh-huh.
I'll be edited out. So I'm going to ask that when you answer questions, try to remember to provide a little context rather than just starting out by saying yes. Say the Civil War had such and such a positive impact on someone. Just so that, and I'll remind you if you don't, I'll stop and we can start.
Yeah, well, as long as you're going to edit it.
Yeah, this will
you
be.
Can always, we can always throw in 30 or 40 other words that you can daub in where you need them.
Hear that, Ralph?
I'm an expert at that.
And also, if you want to stop at any point, take a break, just let me know. And remember, this is going to be edited, so if you come to a point where you sort of stumble, that's fine. We'll
if we strangle or if smash the sentence beyond recall, we know you'll cut it out unless you want to practice real malice. Say this is the way they taught these old guys.
On a few occasions when I've listened to something on tape, I was so horrified by what I said and by the way I said it, that I decided never again to put myself in a position to.
Where they type your tape? That's where you're in real trouble.
Paul Haas, who edits the magazine, sent me the tape of what I must have said at the occasion of this reception that the society gave me. His proposal was that I fix it up a little bit, be published in the Magazine of History, and I said, it would be over my dead body. That perfectly terrible. However,
well, I hate to put you in this position again once more, Professor Curry.
They're not going to type it up.
Oh heavens! I remember over my dead body.
I remember once having. I had the manuscript. I read the manuscript. The person who was transcribing the program didn't know I had a manuscript and sent me the transcription typed up. And it was perfectly marvelous how my enunciation or something went wrong, or the girl who was typing didn't pick up the periods and the new paragraphs. I decided it's best to have a manuscript if you're going to be published later.
If I laugh, I'll laugh silently.
If you laugh, you can laugh. We can take that out, too.
Can you get the laughing filter on up there, guys? Please, if I address a question to or either one of you, or one of you starts talking, the other one is free to cut, just have a dialogue that we would we would prefer something like that if it's appropriate. So let me check with the people upstairs.
Well, he thought he had the mic closed.
Right. I'm talking about you.
Oh.
You just said it.
Oh, I don't care whether it's recorded or not, because you're going to edit out.
That's right, this will be edited.
Okay, all right.
Okay, are we rolling? I think we'll just begin with the writing of the book itself, how that came about. And I think the best place to start is with Professor Curdy.
Right.
And if you could provide some background on how volumes 1 and 2 came to be, and perhaps then draw in on Professor Curtis and his involvement.
Yeah.
Having myself written a book on the social ideas of American educators, I had got interested in the history of higher education, and I felt that most of the histories of colleges and universities had been written without any context. They had been institutional histories. And I decided sometime I would like to try my hand at writing the history of a university and to put it in terms of context. So when I got to Wisconsin in 1942, I began to hear about the centennial, which was coming up in 1948. And it occurred to me that I might suggest to them the writing of a centennial history of the university. And this met with good response. Professor Naplan, the chairman of the history department, was quite keen about it. Dean Ingram of LNS was very sympathetic. And a committee had been appointed, an overall committee, for the planning of the centennial. And that committee was responsive to the idea. So some money was found, and I was asked to undertake this. I was doing some teaching and had a lot of other things, so I was only giving part time to it. I did have a few research assistants, and as I got into it, I saw that if this was ever to be finished by 1948, that it would have to be either a very superficial and a very thin book, and therefore that there ought to be a co-author. Meantime, I had read as many dissertations on histories of university that I could get by interlibrary loan. And the best one by far was by somebody I had never heard of before, von Vernon Carstensen, on the history of the University of Iowa, State University of Iowa, which is simply superb, and did the kind of thing that I had hoped to do, putting the history of the University of Iowa very much in terms of the whole political, economic, and social context of Iowa history. And my colleague Merrill Jensen, it turned out, knew Vernon Carstensen very well and located him as in Washington working on war history. So that was how Vernon Carstensen came and did the magnificent job, not only with the history, but in establishing the archives of the university history, which was an additional contribution that he made to us. So that's the way I think the thing got started.
Tell us about your first contact question two.
Well, I'd been working, had gone from Iowa to Washington State, taught there a while. There's where I met Merrill Jensen. Then signed up as a civilian historian for the War Department. Had gone to Washington and was there, expecting to return to Ellensburg in 1945, when came a letter from Paul Naplan out of the blue saying, would I like to come to Madison and join Merle Curdy in doing the history of the University of Wisconsin? Well, it delighted me, and I had I've often thought, gosh, it was risky. I didn't know Merle, except I knew his work and admired it a great deal. But to join in something like that would have been, I would have considered risky. But I said a kind of yes, and then met Merle. I remember the Washington Hotel.
Was that
and we talked a little about it, and I'd agreed by that time, maybe not. But I got to Madison, and just at the time the war ended in August of 1945. And from there until 1948, I don't think either of us had any time, because there was an enormous amount of work to be done. Even though the research committee gave us 2 and then 4 and finally 6 research assistants, we tried to cover all of the work in the legislature from 1836 to 1925. We tried to go through the newspapers. We tried to go through all of the manuscript collections. We tried to find the records of the regents. And they were pretty careless in the 19th century in taking care of the records. They kept their bare bones minutes, but not all the supporting paper. And parenthetically, we had volume one in type, or there's in print, in galleys, not in pages, when they were clearing out some of the basement of the old administration building across from the Historical Society. Well, that still stood. And somebody called and said, there's some old paper here. Would any of you be interested in it? They had a couple of kids cleaning out the canceled bills and so on. Here was a box of the papers that came to the Regents from 1848 to 57, I think. And I had to take a month. You were off in New England at that time, okay. I think. I had to take a month and go through all of those papers. And it did change. We had to add some things. But the thing I was so pleased with, that we had been able to do pretty well out of other sources, the story that unfolded if we got the papers that came to the board, reports of committees, applications, denunciations from citizens because they were admitting women, things of that sort.
I think we should make it very clear initially that at the time we began this history and during the writing of it, there was absolutely nothing that could be called a university archive. The material was scattered here, there, and everywhere. Some of it was in the attic of Agricultural Hall, some of it in the basement of Bascom Hall, the presidential papers. Some of them had been badly affected by the dampness.
And the rats.
And the rats. What we were greatly handicapped by not having a central place where the basic records of the university's history had been kept. We worked under the most unfavorable conditions, and we were also working against time because as things moved on, the committee made it clear that they felt this appearance of the history was to be one of the major events of the centennial. I think no one can quite understand what the problems of doing this really were in view of the inaccessibility of so much of the material and of the difficulties of finding it, and in some cases, which Vernon will elaborate, of getting actual permission to use it.
Well, I think you know that a little better than I do, but you've heard of the Ely trial. Ely was charged with, I've forgotten the precise thing, but he did things that professor. He supported strikes, didn't he,
and boycotts. He supported strikes.
He was denounced, and the Regents decided to have a trial. They kept a record, and Ely was exonerated in the great statement, the sifting and winnowing statement on the plaque, comes from the exoneration by the Regents. But when we came up to that point in reading, using the Regents' records, we had access, of course, to all records. The Secretary of the Regents told our research assistant that that file on Ely was marked private and confidential, and hence we were not to have access to it. It required our trip to Naplan, and Naplan's telephone call to the president of the board, Mr. Sensenbrenner, and Sensenbrenner's telephone to the Secretary of the Regents before we got access to that collection of papers. And we thought, of course, we were onto something if it was so secret that not even the Secretary of the Board had permission to look at it. Actually, it was one of those cases that are so frequent among the spooks or other people, the suspicious people, they don't know what's in the record, and not knowing, they're afraid that something dangerous might be revealed.
Yeah, they suspect the worst.
Yeah. Standard Oil for many years wouldn't let people into their records because they thought they had material in there that was worse than the things that had been said about them outside. And when they did finally let people in, they found, heavens, they didn't keep the bad things that were said about them. They kept the good things. The same is true of some church records. Same is true of the Hudson's Bay records for a long time. They wouldn't let anybody look at them for fear that the charges against the Hudson's Bay Company would be proven true in their records. The idiots had no notion that they, if they were to be exonerated, it would be there. Well, the Ely papers were included, I think, nothing that we hadn't already seen. But it was a little packet that somebody had put together and named it confidential. One other thing on the records, after we got the archives started, and there's the irony of it, we got the archives started after the two volumes had been produced. Of course, there were more records coming, so it was a good thing to have them, have the records started. In a ventilation tunnel, not a tunnel, but the ventilation pipe, big... fairly big with a trap door, a little tin door in it. We found in about 1952 or 53 a whole batch of records that we would like to have seen because they involved the beginning of the attempt of the faculty to supervise athletics. In the 80s and 90s, the cheating that was done was mostly using professional runners and baseball players instead of football players to go to contests. And the poor faculty had no more luck supervising athletes then than they do now. But we had a great chunk of records were shoved into the ventilation system. We got those down into the archives. And I might just mention a plug for the archives. If you have seen the second printing, do you maybe have the second printing here. In the little bibliographic note, you'll find a listing of all of the books that came out of the archives after it got started. A chunk of documents as rich and as varied as the records of the University of Wisconsin is a challenge to all kinds of historians. And I think Jess Bell put together a list that included maybe a dozen or 15 books that that came directly or indirectly out of the archival collection.
Now,
go ahead.
Yeah, you must have gotten, tell me a little bit about the people, professors and departmental chairs, et cetera, that worked with you during that writing of the history. I assume that you had help from some.
Yes, we did. And we found, in general, the chairman of departments were a little curious as to what we wanted. And in some cases, departmental archives had been pretty well kept. That is, their files were in fairly good order. And in several cases, the chairman of departments, consulting with their colleagues, made memos or brief sketches of what seemed to them to be the principal developments in a given department. In some cases, their memos were real essays. For instance, Dr. Akernecht, who was the professor of the history of medicine in the medical school, did a very elaborate study on the history of the medical school. And in other
which
cases,
we used
which
almost.
Which we used virtually as it was.
Yeah.
And in other cases, these little essays were, in all cases, they were helpful, and in some cases, very helpful. I think the writing of the history had some effect on all of the departments in making an effort thenceforth to keep their files even in better shape. Thanks to Carstensen's efforts, the University Archives did get established. This was one of his great contributions. And with that, I think the departments began sending their older files to the archives, and were a little bit more interested in keeping good files thereafter. So we were, of course, very much indebted to members of the faculty, both chairman and, in some cases, older members, for contributions, both orally and, in some cases, written memos or little essays. All of them were, as I can remember, Vernon can contradict me if I'm wrong, all of them wanted to be helpful. And I think, though in the beginning, some of them seemed to wonder just what we were about.
Some were a little puzzled.
They were a little puzzled.
And some had a very large ignorance of the history of their department.
Yes.
And this was true of some of the schools. Engineering had almost no records, as I remember. Law had fairly bad records.
Which is interesting, because you would have expected law to have good records.
Extension had pretty good records, although, let's see, I've forgotten what the point was there. There are some records got destroyed while we were using them. One Seth, I still mourn its loss from the late 1870s on until the 1930s. The university faculty was charged with the responsibility for going out to examine high schools to accredit them. And the situation seemed to be something like this: a school wanting to be accredited for a four-year program for university, so that students could be admitted, graduates could be admitted to the university, would write to the secretary of faculty and asked to be inspected. And a member of the faculty would go out, visit classes, maybe make a public lecture, and people would pay 25 cents or something to raise the money to cover the expenses. And on coming back, the professor, usually it was just one, there might be two, but usually it was only one, would write a report on the teaching, the qualifications of the teachers, and the teaching. And on a basis of that, the faculty would vote to admit without examination to the freshman class. There was in Bascom Hall probably a collection of, I wouldn't guess, but I suppose 500, 600, 700 of these reports running from the 70s up to about the 1920s, giving little vignettes of the public schools, the high schools of Wisconsin. And I had had an opportunity to examine a few of them, and was coming back, and an over-eager secretary looked in it and decided this is of no consequence, and threw the whole batch out. And I could have wept when I found out that you could reestablish most of that stuff, I suppose, in other ways, but it would be a monumental task. And here it was, all together, a picture of how our schools operated, or different schools over the state. Wouldn't that have been a dandy to have now?
And it would have, of course, also given us, and historians of education generally, a very good idea of what conceptions of standards were.
Yeah, and those who say our standards are so low now might have seen some schools that had really low standards, where you had teachers who couldn't both read and write, if they could read or write. That's as much as you could expect of them.
How did the two of you go about dividing your work up?
Oh, that, let's see. The way we were organized, we had weekly meetings of the students and Merle and I, and we talked over what we'd done. And I think we were in it 6 months, weren't we, or so, before we agreed. And this, I don't think any of us could claim monopoly on having developed this structure. But out of those first months of research, we formulated, I think, a kind of plan of what the major themes probably would be, and discussed those with our research assistants. We talked about them. We tried probably a number of outlines, didn't we?
I think so.
And finally hit on a kind of a general one with the major themes that we were going to develop. And that's about the way it happened. And then we talked further, and in case you're interested in the actual mechanics, we worked it pretty much as you see it in the table of contents now. Murrow would take one chapter, I'd take another. We were all the beneficiaries of all the research work and discussion and the notes that had been collected. And we'd write it, and the graduate students who were working at the time would read the essays, add or subtract, as the case might be, and then we'd run it through the first typing. That's about the way we worked. Of course, I also discovered that to work in kind of double team with Merle Curdy, I was awfully glad he was teaching nearly a full course and writing another book and so on, because by my working full time, 6 days a week, I could keep up with Merle while working.
He did, of course, infinitely more than I did.
I don't think so. We do. We wrote about equal amounts. But
the trouble
with Merle is he'd write this darn stuff off. Bingo, he'd remember everything and it would all fall into place. I'd sweat and go through it and so on, but I almost kept up. Thank goodness you were busy on lots of other things.
Vernon did the major part of this.
It is true that I was teaching
a fairly full program.
And running a batch of graduate students.
And I had many too many graduate students. But in any case, I think the outline, the structure of the book emerged pretty much the way Vernon says. We had agreed in the beginning that we didn't want a merely institutional history. We wanted to flesh it out and do as much as we could to show what the state, the people who were running the state, what they expected from a university, and how the early chancellors and members of the faculty responded. And I think we were also very much interested in knowing as much as we could about the kind of students who came here and what was actually taught in the classes. This was often very hard to get at because we found relatively few students' notes for the histories of medieval universities. Historians have found in many cases notes which these medieval students took on the lectures. We found very few things. That we did find one or two splendid series of notes from lectures that Frederick Jackson Turner had given. But in general, this was one of the lacunae. We didn't have a great deal from. Often students later at reunions would reminisce about President Bascom and his famous courses. He covered many subjects, philosophy, psychology, theology, social ethics, and apparently was a remarkable teacher. Sometimes we had some reminiscences of what people remembered as having got from President Bascom. In general, there was inadequate records for the faculty themselves, as there was as to what they conceived their courses to be, and actually the changing contents as years went by. So we would have liked to have had more material of that kind than we were able to find. Relatively few student letters. I came across just a few years ago a book which would have been really very useful had it been published at the time we were doing this. was published in about 1971, a student here had written his autobiography, and he went into great detail in regard to student life, and particularly the professors that he worked with, and the student clubs and organizations. This was Jeffrey, the moment I forgot his name, Horace Gregory, who went on to become a very distinguished classicist, writing distinguished translations of the Latin classics, and becoming a great teacher at Sarah Lawrence, and a poet, perhaps a minor poet, but a very good poet, whose poems appeared regularly in The Nation and The New Republic and have been collected in several volumes. Finally, the English department, shortly before his death, got around to recommending him for an honorary degree. And I was immensely pleased, both because he seems to me to have been one of the rather outstanding students from the early 1920s. We stopped technically at 1925, but he was here from about 1919 to 1924, then went to Greenwich Village and had some flirtations with leftward movements. But we found there are very few things of this kind that were available.
We did have the Solon Justin Buck.
Solon Buck.
Buck's letters. He was the first archivist of the United States. Yes. He let us use his all his correspondence. He was an archivist from the time he came here, I guess, and he instructed his parents. He rode down on his bicycle, and he wrote to his parents every week and instructed them to keep his postcards and his letters in order. And Justin Buck's letters. He was the first archivist of the United States. Yes. He let us use his all his correspondence. He was an archivist from the time he came here, I guess, and he instructed his parents. He rode down on his bicycle, and he wrote to his parents every week and instructed them to keep his postcards and his letters in order. And I remember that I went through most of that and got a note or two. Mostly he reported on what we had for Sunday dinner and where I kept my wheel and a few things of that sort. But I do remember he was here in the early 1890s, I believe. Right. And at that time, this was before the appearance of the first Dean of Women. He lived in a rooming house, and he described the other people in the rooming house. It was a heterosexual rooming house. We didn't have a dean of women to see to it that the girls were properly protected. So everybody in the house, not all of the people renting rooms, I think, were students. It was adjacent to the campus. It had a few girls who were students, a few boys, and a few other people. And I remember having paused at that one a little. My goodness, I thought deans of women and segregation were born with the university. But 'twarn't so at all. It isn't until we get the dean of women to supervise the behavior of the girls that we get segregated rooming houses. Of course, Chadburn. You still call it Chadburn?
Yeah.
Or is it
still Chadburn?
Holidays Chadburn or something. The first one was a great dormitory. First girls' dormitory were west of the Mississippi, except we aren't west of the Mississippi, are we?
I think so.
In the west. And the
Wisconsin limestone.
Engineering department used to, you won't use this, I'm sure, but they used to boast about the fact that it was the only four-story privy in Wisconsin. and they had, and I'll bet they still have in the engineering department, the blueprint, which shows the privy, and they had some people who had to come and clean it.
And in their ribald moments, the students made the most of this.
Yeah.
I can believe it.
Yeah.
I'll talk for a second about students. Now, you said you had a few reminiscences, one after they came a little too late for the...
Yeah.
And the other one you mentioned. Where did you go about getting most of your information in student life?
They had a student newspaper. They had their yearbook.
Could you just start that with, we got most of
We got most of the information from... such things as the student newspaper. They had a literary mag from time to time, and that would have those long, thoughtful, brooding articles about what is life and where does it lead. For a while, they had senior examinations, some of which are kept in the archives. They were carefully drawn out and were apparently available for inspection. But there was their daily newspaper, their literary paper, the few of the things we saw. We saw things in them. We went through all of the Madison newspapers. And anytime they got into trouble or achieved great things, when La Follette, for example, won the Interstate Oratorical Contest, and there was a great parade around the square to celebrate it. These things got into the newspaper. Or when the students rioted. There was a time they broke up one of the theaters downtown and were seen drinking beer and things like that before the riot started. That would get into the newspapers. Now, that's on the far fringes of misbehavior. We also had, in the 19th century, beginning in the 50s, men's literary societies and debate clubs with manuscript records kept of their debate topics, of their concerns and interests. We went through that material. Parenthetically, we're now in Vilas Hall, aren't we? Named after William Freeman Vilas? Whose father had come from Vermont with a little money. He bought lots, including the lot under which the Humanities Building is now located. He was a minor politician. His 16-year-old son, as a student in the university in the 50s, late 50s, sorry, in the late 50s, was anxious to organize a literary society, and he and a couple of his friends, maybe they got hold of a lawyer or something, I don't know, but they drew up a charter for their literary society. These kids went down to the legislature and asked the legislature to pass a bill chartering their literary society, and they got it through. I don't know whether 16-year-olds would do that anymore. But then Vilas...
They might. Some of them are quite sophisticated.
Vilas was quite a case. Well, anyhow, you have those records, and they run through the rest of the century. And they tell us quite a bit about what was important. The literary societies developed here something called the joint debate, about which I think we say something in the history. And it was interesting that the people... the men mostly, women seldom made it. They went through a competition within the societies to pick, I believe, the four outstanding debaters, usually seniors. And they had the joint debates in the spring of the senior year on a subject that had been identified a year before. It wasn't unusual for these people to put in as much as a whole summer of research on the topic to be debated. I remember one account of a man who subsequently became a very important official in Chicago traction company, who had been invited. He was on the side against public ownership of street railways and power companies. He was invited down to Chicago to be in part of their organization for a summer. and his side won. They came out against the public ownership of traction companies, and after he graduated, he was invited back to join the company, and within 20 years, he was one of the high officers in the company. That suggested something when I ran into that, and subsequently, I remember encountering a record of the looking at the subsequent careers of the young people who had made it in joint debate. They were the governors, the senators, the judges, people who went quickly to fairly distinguished careers. Now, the speech department at one time argued that it was joint debate that made them. I think we took a different view, didn't we, Merle? We decided joint debate was the way you attained distinction. And these young people were the people who wanted recognition, and they got it in joint debate here as they got it later in politics, yeah, or law or whatever they went into.
And some of them made capital at the commencement by giving the commencement parts. The newspapers were, I think, the best sources we had for commencement. And commencement was a fiesta. It was a state day, almost a state holiday. The newspapers in Milwaukee reported commencement in great detail. And particularly these debaters, these literary society people, as against the athletes, really flourished. They had their day on commencement. But in regard to the student papers, the Aegis, I think, published somewhat more substantially serious articles, and it was in that the young Frederick Jackson Turner, an instructor in rhetoric, published some very notable essays, one particularly called The Significance of History. This was in a student paper, and in many ways it is as important an article as his better-known Significance of the Frontier in History, because in this article, in the student paper, The Significance of History, Turner outlined what he thought historians should do, and I think one could argue that virtually everything that historians have done since that time anticipated even quantification, certainly urban history, and immigrant history. It was a remarkable program for historical research appearing mm-hmm. in one of these student papers.
What did you learn in general about students over time at UW, starting the very first students up until the period ended?
Well, of course, in the beginning, there were very few students qualified for even such entrance requirements that the university put. There were very few high schools and academies in Wisconsin, so the university started really with a preparatory school, and the first instruction was really not much more than preparatory school instruction, and it continued that for a long time. The early classes were very small, and I think the students were to a considerable extent Madison students, though there were some from other places. But I think one would find in the history something in regard to the changing character of the student body. Certainly, the increasing size, it never became mm-hmm. very large. And then in the 19th century, it was still something that we might think of as a small liberal arts college with a law school and an agricultural school attached to a small liberal arts college. Until the 20th century, until the Van Hise period, I don't think there's so much to be thought of in terms of a modern university as it was something on the road, hoping to become a modern university.
But I think you wouldn't just say, Merle, the students gave the impression of being more sedate, more mature when they came to the university, but also, in some respects, wonderfully naive. We have record of one student in the 50s, record isn't very clear, but it's there, of when the student dormitory was North Hall, I think. He needed wood for his stove, so he went out on the campus and cut down a tree. I don't think a student now would, he might cut down a tree, but he wouldn't cut down a tree for his stove. Students, they probably still do this, some of them. Remember, we had that one chap whose name won't come back to me, who later became a bishop, who wrote about his in his reminiscences. He went home every week or every other week and brought back 10 or 20 pounds of beans and dried beef and things of that sort, yeah. And he did his own cooking. John Muir talks about boiling oats or oatmeal in his room in South Hall. Now you have that one end of the students. You have them working and much more, they're much more unsophisticated, yeah. Of course. Now you'll get freshmen students who have probably, they might have been in Rome or in Africa, or might even have taken the trip to the Orient, that kind of thing, that wasn't true.
These were largely farm boys.
Yeah, so and girls. Was,
and girls.
We accepted the girls reluctantly.
Very reluctantly. But I think many of them were earnest, hoping, looking at the university as a way of getting ahead. The fathers of the university like to emphasize the civic functions of the university, that it was to make good citizens and strengthen the republic. They also, of course, recognized the utilitarian value, the need of developing trained farmers and lawyers. There was no medical school. Mm-hmm. But there was hope that sometime there would be a medical school. So, but I think they at least in their rhetoric, they expressed fervent hopes that the university would contribute to the